In 2025, Duke Energy reported a return on equity of roughly 12%.
Right, which, I mean, if you're just looking at a stock screener, that looks incredibly healthy.
Yeah, exactly. It looks great. And they pay their dividend, you know, which sends this strong signal of stability to the broader market. But if you peer just beneath that pristine surface, you hit a really striking financial paradox. In that exact same year, Duke spent $14 billion on capital expenditure against just $5 billion in net income. They generated negative $1.7 billion in free cash flow. And to bridge that massive gap, they issued $11.9 billion in long-term debt.
It's a profound contradiction when you really look at it. You have this 12% return that is absolutely real in the strict accounting sense, right? But the cash actually deployed to build the business, you know, to lay the physical infrastructure, it didn't come from the business itself. The whole architecture of that return is this optical illusion maintained entirely by external financing.
And dissecting that illusion is our mission for this deep dive today. We're doing an analytical exploration of a book called The Infinite Investor, which is it's a fascinating volume from the Averaging Up collection.
It really is.
We're going to deconstruct the mechanics of what the text calls capital absorption. Basically, we want to understand why true heavy tool compounders are just incredibly rare in the wild.
Yeah, because we're all taught to look at return on equity or ROE as like the ultimate measure of a management team's performance. But the real danger of ROE is that it is completely blind to where the money actually comes from. When you only look at that first figure, you'll inevitably conclude that a company is successfully compounding the capital you, the shareholder, have committed.
But the reality shifts entirely when you put the cash flow statement and the debt issuance right next to the income statement.
Exactly. I mean, the fundamental argument for owning a capital-intensive, heavy toll business, like a utility or a railroad or a waste management network, is that it possesses the physical capacity to absorb massive amounts of capital at a sustained return.
So you're basically accepting a modest rate of return in exchange for just the sheer staggering volume of capital the business can actually put to work.
That's the theory, yeah.
So let's actually slow down and break down that ROE illusion, because it's sort of the trap door that so many portfolios fall through. ROE only looks at the shareholder's sliver of the pie. It's like, okay, think of it this way. If you set up a lemonade stand with $10 of your own money and $90 of borrowed money, and you make $5 in profit, your return on equity looks amazing. It's 50%.
A 50% return. Yeah. Any investor would take that.
But your return on the actual capital invested to build the stand the full $100 is only 5%. You aren't some genius compounding machine. You're just heavily in debt.
And that is the perfect framework for understanding Duke's $14 billion in capital expenditure. To see how they hide the source of the capital, we really have to look at the mechanics of utility accounting. Because that $14 billion doesn't appear as a massive expense on the income statement, dragging down profits. Instead, it's capitalized.
Wait, so let me just make sure I'm following the actual mechanics there.
Yeah.
If they spend billions pouring concrete and, you know, laying transmission lines, they don't count that as a current expense.
Nope.
It just gets shifted over to the balance sheet as an asset, meaning their reported profits just look totally untouched.
That is exactly how it functions. Only the depreciation of that physical asset, which is, you know, a tiny incremental fraction of the total outlay spread over decades, actually hits the earnings in any given year. So the net income is artificially preserved on paper, while billions in actual physical cash are bleeding out the door to contractors and suppliers. And this is where the specific regulatory environment of utilities just supercharges the illusion.
Because of the rate base, right?
The regulator authorizes a return, usually around 9 to 10% on that newly enlarged asset base. In utility parlance, that's the rate base. Because the regulator essentially guarantees a return on whatever is spent and approved, the earnings mechanically rise in lockstep with the spending.
So the more they spend, the more they make.
And this happens utterly independent of whether the company generated a single dollar of organic cash from its own operations to fund the construction.
And then leverage kind of completes the trick,
Exactly.
right? By financing that construction with debt, the company grows the numerator, the earnings, without diluting the equity, which is the denominator. So a 12% return on equity at like a 1.5 debt to equity ratio is actually a return on invested capital, or ROIC, of somewhere near 5 or 6%. You know, the aviation leasing company AerCap is perhaps the most stripped down aggressive version of this mechanic.
Oh, yeah. That's a great example.
They show a staggering return on equity of 21.1%. Mm. But their return on invested capital is just 6.03%. And they've run negative free cash flow for a decade.
It's incredible.
But let me push back here for a second. For heavily regulated utilities, isn't this basically the agreed upon model? Like, the government functionally guarantees this arrangement. So why does the text frame this as a dangerous race against solvency rather than just, you know, a stable, predictable machine?
Well, it is the established model, but it's a model constrained by unforgiving mathematical limits. Debt isn't infinite.
Right.
If we look specifically at Duke Energy, their ratio of funds from operations to debt, it currently sits near 14.8%.
Okay, and why does that matter?
Because that is precariously below the 15% threshold typically required by rating agencies to maintain their current credit rating.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. They've been flirting just below that line for several years now, all while aggressively pushing a $103 billion capital plan.
That's a massive plan.
Right. So when a business absorbs capital so heavily that its core solvency begins to structurally erode, it ceases to be a stable compounding machine. The expanding balance sheet isn't actually creating wealth. It's simply manufacturing a larger liability.
Okay, so if borrowing to build is basically just a countdown to a credit downgrade, how should a company actually compound wealth?
Well, the infinite investor establishes that for a heavy toll business to actually be worth owning, three very strict conditions have to be met.
Okay, what are they?
First, the reinvestment has to actually happen. Second, it has to be funded by the company's own internally generated cash. And third, that money must earn more than its cost of capital.
Got it. So let's talk about what happens when companies try to take shortcuts around those rules.
Yeah.
If Duke Energy is the baseline failure where capital is, you know, raised but not retained, mm-hmm. what happens when a company tries to buy its way to growth instead of borrowing?
That brings us to the second type of failure the text outlines, where the base is purchased, but it does not earn. Canadian Pacific Kansas City, or CPKC, is the prime case study here. They absorbed Kansas City Southern in a massive $31 billion acquisition. And to fund it, they paid heavily in stock. Shares outstanding rose from 731 million to 901 million.
Which is, I mean, that's a 23% dilution for existing shareholders.
It's massive.
They gave away nearly a quarter of the company to buy a competitor, but they acquired a great functioning railroad, right? Like a massive tangible asset. So why did their return on invested capital completely collapse? Because it fell from over 16% in 2020 down to under 7% in early 2026.
Because when you buy an asset at a massive premium, you are bloating the denominator of your return calculation.
Okay.
You're expanding the invested capital base far faster than the earnings can ever catch up. The incremental return, which is the actual additional earnings generated divided by the additional capital deployed, was a dismal 4%.
4%? Wow.
And that sits well below their estimated cost of capital, which is around 7 to 8%.
So they're destroying value on every new dollar. And the market, I mean, they price that value destruction in almost immediately. CPKC's price-to-book ratio plummeted from over 6 down to under 2.
Yeah, the market saw right through it.
And, of course, the market was promised synergies. Ah. The classic Wall Street promise, right?
Always.
First, they were promised for 2024, then pushed to 2025, then pushed again to 2027.
Right, and a return that fails to rise over half a decade is not a return waiting to miraculously expand. It is simply a poor return. The base expanded, but the rate of return was completely crushed by the purchase price.
Okay, so CPKC destroyed value by overpaying and diluting shareholders. But what if a company buys great assets at good prices and actually manages to expand its operating margins while throwing off cash?
That's where things get tricky.
Yeah, because looking at the third type of failure in the book, which focuses on waste connections, I mean, it seems absolutely flawless to the naked eye. Morningstar assigns them a wide economic moat and low uncertainty. Their landfills are legally irreplaceable. So for the listener holding this stock, why isn't an irreplaceable high margin monopoly enough?
It's the most insidious type of failure, precisely because every surface-level signal looks like a victory.
It looks perfect.
It really does. Waste Connections generates $1.4 billion in free cash flow, growing at double digits. Their operating margins have expanded significantly across the decade, jumping from 14.2% to 19.2%.
Those are great numbers.
They are. But scarcity by itself does not equal compounding. Scarcity is simply monetized. Despite those dominant margins, Waste Connections' return on invested capital is only 7.86%.
Wow.
Yeah, and against a cost of capital of 7 to 8%, their spread is functionally zero.
Okay, so is this basically the classic goodwill trap? It's kind of like buying a house worth $100,000 for $300,000 just because it's in a really exclusive neighborhood?
That's a perfect analogy.
Right. That extra $200,000 is accounting goodwill. Mm. It just sits on your balance sheet forever. You have to earn a return on that larger amount. But the physical house still only generates the exact same amount of rent. Is that what's dragging down the return?
That is exactly what's happening. It's a brilliant way to conceptualize it. Their entire growth strategy relies on external absorption. They've completed over 500 acquisitions.
Wait, over 500?
Over 500. 19 in a single recent year alone.
It's exhausting just to think about.
Right. And every time they buy a regional landfill or a competitor, they're paying that neighborhood premium you mentioned. They add massive amounts of goodwill to their invested capital base, but the incremental cash flow they acquire doesn't keep up with the premiums they paid.
Ah.
And on top of that, their organic growth is driven entirely by aggressive price hikes. The physical volumes of waste they process have actually been steadily declining.
So they're charging more to process less just to keep the earnings flat against this totally swollen balance sheet.
Exactly. And if a company absorbs vast quantities of capital at a return exactly equal to its cost, it creates absolutely nothing of economic value over any time horizon. The balance sheet gets larger, the revenues go up, but the shareholder merely receives their cost of capital back.
So a wide moat just isn't enough.
No, it's not. There has to be a mechanical spread between what the capital costs and what it's engineered to earn.
Which, I mean, that begs the obvious question.
Yeah.
If buying competitors at a premium destroys the return and borrowing money just hollows out your solvency, how does anyone actually pull this off? Like, how do businesses expand their capital base without ruining the underlying math?
Well, the book outlines a hierarchy of positive capital absorption. The first tier of success is called the inherited spread.
Huh?
Canadian National Railroad is the archetype here. They boast a very healthy 12.6% return on invested capital against that same 7 to 8% cost.
So that's a real spread of roughly 5 points,
yep.
Which technically means they're compounding value. But the text points out a fatal flaw here too,
mm-hmm.
right? Because a closer look reveals their margins and their ROIC are actually in a long-term secular decline.
Yes, they are.
Their net income has fallen, while their capital expenditure has risen by 37%. So they aren't actually absorbing new capital efficiently at all.
Right. Canadian National looks highly successful on average, but that average return remains elevated solely because the vast physical majority of their network was built and paid for a century ago.
Ah, so the old assets are carrying the weight.
Exactly. The historical capital is doing all the heavy lifting. The new marginal capital they're committing today is essentially producing nothing. It's really a cautionary tale for investors about trusting historical average returns over present-day incremental returns.
Because the buyer of a share today is acquiring the reality of the incremental return, right? Not the glory of the historical average. So if an old network is just coasting on its history, who is actually absorbing massive new capital and succeeding? You mentioned Lind earlier in your notes, the industrial gas giant. They represent what the book calls the flat spread.
Right.
They essentially doubled their entire asset base by acquiring Praxair, which meant severely diluting their shares. Initially, it looked like CPKC all over again. Their ROIC collapsed from over 11% down to under 4%.
But here's where Lynn really diverges from the failures. It took 6 grueling years of integration, but Lynn managed to recover that return. They brought it back to 11.1%.
That's incredible.
Yeah, they absorbed a massive global competitor, doubled their invested capital base, and actually managed to hold their rate of return steady, keeping it above their cost of capital.
You highlight this concept in the analysis called the descending opportunity curve.
Mm-hmm.
Can you explain what that physical reality is for a business and why it makes Lynn's recovery so rare?
Sure. So in capital deployment, there's basically an iron law. The opportunity curve always descends. A rational management team will naturally undertake their highest returning, most spectacularly efficient projects first, the low-hanging fruit.
Makes sense.
Therefore, the next project will naturally be a little harder, a little less profitable. Absorbing more and more capital should, by definition, dilute the rate of return earned upon it.
Because all the best ideas are already taken.
Exactly. So for Lind to absorb an entire global competitor, double the size of its physical base, and emerge with its spread completely intact, it's monumental. Because they maintain that 4-point spread across a base that was twice as large, the absolute value they created literally multiplied.
But if the opportunity curve inevitably descends, maintaining a flat spread like Lind is already kind of defying financial gravity. Is it mechanically possible for a company to not just maintain but actually increase its rate of return as it gets bigger?
It is mechanically possible, yes, but it requires an asset that money cannot buy. This brings us to the ultimate tier in the hierarchy of absorption, the rising rate.
Okay, the rising rate.
This is a regime where both engines run simultaneously, the base grows, and the rate earned on that base actually improves. The archetype the text presents for this is Union Pacific.
Union Pacific, right. They retain roughly 55% of their earnings. They take $3.79 billion, which is like 41% of their operating cash flow, and relentlessly reinvest it into a 30,000-mile network.
Yep.
And crucially, every single cent of that absorption is funded entirely from within by $5.86 billion in free cash flow.
Yeah.
No new debt to fund the core compounding. No massive share dilution to buy a competitor.
And the result completely shatters that descending opportunity curve we just talked about. Over a 10-year period, Union Pacific's return on invested capital didn't just hold steady like Lind. It actually rose from 13.35% to 16.23%.
That's wild. Their net income rose by 69%, while their capital expenditure only increased by 8%. That is just a breathtaking level of efficiency.
It really is.
But why does this unpurchasable second engine of a rising rate exist for them and not for, say, Waste Connections or CPKC?
Because you cannot go into the market and buy a rising rate. When Waste Connections buys a regional landfill or CPKC buys Kansas City Southern, they are purchasing a base at market price.
Right.
And an asset purchase at market price will, at best, earn the market return. To achieve a rising rate, you must fundamentally improve an unfinished asset you already own.
An asset that is basically entirely unrepeatable.
Exactly. Union Pacific's original tracks were laid in 1862. You could not replicate that 30,000-mile network today with all the sovereign wealth capital in the world.
It's impossible.
Right. The capital they commit today does not buy a new network at a premium. It buys extreme physical efficiency within the existing congested network. It double tracks a bottleneck. It lengthens a train siding so they can run 3-mile-long trains. It reduces terminal dwell time. Every marginal dollar is spent on density and velocity, pushing more volume through a fixed, fully depreciated asset. That is the physics of how the rate rises as the base expands.
So the ultimate lesson from the infinite investor is that capital absorption is the one competitive advantage a company cannot purchase.
Mm.
You can buy competitors, you can lobby for rate bases, but you cannot buy the internal physics of an improving return on an irreplaceable asset.
Right. It requires all three of those demanding conditions operating in perfect concert. The reinvestment must be massive and continuous. It must be funded internally by the cash the business actually generates, avoiding that solvency race of external debt we saw with Duke.
Yeah.
And it must generate a sustained spread above the cost of capital. When those three align on an unfinished, unrepeatable asset, that's when you achieve true compounding.
We started this deep dive looking at an optical illusion, right? The facade of Duke Energy's healthy return on equity, masking a foundation built entirely on borrowed capital. And the stark reality is that the vast majority of capital-intensive businesses are operating exactly like that.
Well, fortunately, yeah.
They're just renting their growth from the debt markets, pushing the limits of their solvency just to maintain the appearance of progress.
And the math always eventually catches up to the illusion. Wealth is not created by merely enlarging a balance sheet. It is created strictly by the spread between the cost of a dollar and what that dollar is physically engineered to produce.
Which leaves you, the listener, with a really critical analytical lens to apply to your own portfolio. As we watch the rise of AI data centers requiring trillions of dollars in new power infrastructure, ask yourself, are the utilities and heavy toll businesses building them actually going to compound your wealth through an unpurchasable second engine funded by their own immense cash flow? Or are we about to witness the largest debt-fueled accounting mirage in market history, just quietly hollowing out while we all stare at the return on equity? This content is educational and reflects a personal analytical framework. It does not constitute investment advice. Visit averagingup.com.